and at feeling relief. It was only that Avasarala had died. I did. Bobby poured out shots for each of them, then raised one. She was a hell of a woman. We won't see her like again. They touched glasses, and Naomi drank. Losing the old woman was hard. Harder for Bobby, probably, than any of the rest of them. But they weren't mourning Amos yet. Or Jim. So, Bobby said, putting down her glass, how's life as the secret general of the resistance? I prefer secret diplomat, Naomi said. And it's underwhelming.
Wait, 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 Alex said. Can't talk without food. It's not family unless there's a meal.
The restaurant did a good Belt Mars fusion menu. Something called white kibble that was related to the real thing, but with fresh vegetables and bean sprouts. Rounds of vat-grown beef-pork hybrid cooked in the shape of a petri dish and touched with a sweet hot sauce. They leaned on the table here the way they had on the Rocinante in their previous incarnations. Naomi hadn't realized how much she missed Bobby's laugh or Alex's way of sneaking another small helping onto her plate when she was almost finished eating. The little intimacies of living in close quarters with someone for decades, and then not living there anymore. It might have made her sad if it weren't for the pleasure of being there in the moment with the two of them. The storm's crewed up pretty well, Bobby was saying. I was worried for a while that it would be straight belters. I mean, that's where Saba's bench is the deepest. Two Martian vets running a crew full of folks who still call us inners. Could have been a problem, Naomi agreed.
Saba pulled a whole sheet of UNN and MCRN vets, Alex said. Young ones, too. Weird being around people who were the age I was when I mustered out. They looked like babies, you know, all fresh-faced and serious.
Naomi laughed. I know. Anyone under 40 looks like a child to me now. They're good, Bobby said. I've been running drills and simulations the whole time we've been parked.
There have been a couple of fights, Alex said.
It's just nerves, Bobby said. When this mission's done, that ship will evaporate. Naomi took another bite of white kibble so that she wouldn't frown. It didn't work, though. Alex cleared his throat and spoke in his changing the subject voice.
I'm guessing there's still no word from the big guy?
2 years before, Saba had found a chance to slip an operative into Laconia itself with a pocket nuke and an encrypted recall and retrieve transmitter. A long odds mission to get Jim back, or destroy Laconia's rule by cutting off its head. Saba had asked Naomi who she would trust with something that important, that dangerous. When Amos heard about it, he packed his bags in the same hour. Since then, Laconia had built new defenses. The underground had lost most of its presence in Laconia's system, and Amos had gone silent. Naomi shook her head. Not yet.
Yeah, well, Alex said. Soon, probably.
Probably, Naomi agreed, the same way she did every time they had this conversation.
You two want any coffee?
Alex asked. Bobby shook her head at the same time Naomi said, not for me. And Alex popped up.
I'll go settle up then.
When the door closed behind him, Naomi leaned forward. She wanted to leave the moment where it was, a reunion with family. A bright spot in the darkness. She wanted to, and she couldn't. A mission with the storm and soul system is a hell of a risk, she said.
It stands a real chance of getting some attention,
Bobby agreed, not making eye contact. Her tone was light, but there was a warning in it.
It's not just me, you know.
Saba. And others.
I keep thinking about Avasarala, Naomi said.
There was still some whiskey in the bottle, and she poured herself a finger. She was a hell of a fighter. Never backed down from anything, even when she lost.
She was one of a kind, Bobby agreed.
She was a fighter, but she wasn't a warrior.
She was always leading the struggle, but she did it by finding other ways to get the work done. Alliances, political pressure, trade, logistics. Her strategy was always that violence came last.
She had leverage, Bobby said. She ran a planet. We're a bunch of rats looking for cracks in the concrete. We're going to do things differently.
We have leverage, Naomi said. And more than that, we can cultivate leverage.
Bobby put down her fork very carefully. The darkness in her eyes wasn't anger, or it wasn't just anger, anyway.
Laconia is a military dictatorship. If you want anyone to stand against Duarte, we have to show people that he can be stood against. Military action is what shows people that there's hope. You're a belter, Naomi. You know this.
I know that it doesn't work, Naomi said. The belt fought for generations against the inner planets and won, Bobby said.
We didn't, though. We didn't win. We held on until something came in and knocked over the playing board. Do you really think we'd have gotten something like the Transport Union if the gates hadn't appeared? The only way we succeeded was by something totally unexpected changing the rules. Only now we're acting like it'll work twice.
We're acting?
Saba's acting, Naomi said. And you're backing him. Bobby leaned back, stretching the way she did when she was annoyed. It made her seem even bigger than she was, but Naomi was a hard woman to intimidate.
I know you disagree with the approach, and I know you're not happy that Saba didn't put you in on the details, but that's not the issue, Naomi said.
No one's arguing against leverage. No one's saying that we shouldn't be looking for political angles, too, but pacifism only works when your enemy has a conscience. Laconia has a deep tradition of discipline through punishment, and I know... No, hear me out. I know that because it's a Martian tradition, too. You grew up with the belt, but I grew up with Mars. You tell me that my way doesn't lead to victory? Okay, I believe you, but I'm telling you that your soft approach doesn't work on these people.
So where does that leave us?
Same place as always, Bobby said. Doing the best we can for as long as we can and hoping something unexpected happens.
On the upside, something unexpected almost always does.
That's not as comforting as you think, Naomi said with a chuckle, trying to lighten the mood.
Bobby wasn't having it.
Because sometimes the thing we don't expect is that we lost Clarissa and Holden, or that we lost Amos, or that we lose me or Alex or you.
But that's going to happen.
We're all going to lose each other eventually, and that's been true since before we were a crew. That's what being born means. Everything else is just specifics. And my specifics are that I'm leading a top-secret military mission in Sol System, using the enemy's captured ship against them, because even if it's a bad plan, it's the only plan I have. And maybe my risk will get you your leverage.
But I don't want you to risk anything, Naomi thought. I've lost too much. I can't stand to lose anything more.
Bobby's features softened just a little. So maybe she understood.
The familiar tap of a footstep outside the door was Alex, as clearly as if he'd said his name. Naomi took a deep breath and forced herself to relax. She didn't want to spoil the reunion for him, too.
Chapter 3. Alex.
Bobby and Naomi were at it again. They played it cool when Alex came back into the room, but he could tell a heated conversation had been going on while he was away. Naomi was dipping her head, letting her hair fall in front of her eyes the way she did when she was upset. Bobby's face was a shade darker than usual, flushed with excitement or anger. Alex had lived on the same small ship with Naomi for decades, and Bobby only a little less. There was almost nothing they could conceal from each other. It hurt his feelings a little that they were even trying to hide it, because that meant he had to hide it too.
All settled up, Alex said.
Bobby nodded and drummed her fingers on the table. Naomi gave him a small smile through her hair.
Alex would have put money that their argument was the same one they'd been rehashing since they'd left Freehold. Pretending like nothing was wrong was the only safe choice. A wise man doesn't get between two fighting animals, but even a dim bulb didn't step into an argument between Naomi Nagata and Bobby Draper. Not if he wanted to keep all his fingers. Metaphorically speaking, of course. "So," Alex started, letting the word draw out until it became awkward. "Yeah," Naomi answered. "I've got a lot to do before I climb back into my storage crate." Bobby nodded, started to speak, and then stopped. In the blink of an eye, she'd crossed the distance to Naomi and swept her up in her massive arms. While the two women were close to the same height, Bobby outweighed Naomi by at least 40 kilos. It was like watching a polar bear grapple a coat rack. But it wasn't the beginning of a fight, because both women were crying and patting each other on the back. "It was good to see you," Bobby said, hugging Naomi a little tighter and lifting her off the deck. "I miss you," Naomi answered. "Both of you. More than I can say." The "both of you" felt like an invitation, so Alex moved in and threw his arms around the two of them. A moment later, he was weeping too. After a while, when it felt right, they separated. Bobby wiped her eyes with a napkin, but Naomi ignored the streaks down her face. She was smiling. Alex realized it was maybe the first real smile he'd seen from her since Holden had been taken to Laconia. It made him wonder how lonely her life was now, hidden away in her cargo container, moving from ship to ship and station to station. Even though it was the choice they'd all made together, he felt a pang of guilt for leaving her alone like that. But Bobby had needed a pilot, and Naomi, in her wandering statesman role, didn't, and didn't want one. "When will we see you again?" Bobby asked. "I wish I knew," Naomi replied. "You guys going to be in Seoul long?" "Not up to me," Bobby said with a shrug. In this case, it was true, but even if it hadn't been, the answer would have been the same. You never knew who was listening. And even here, on a transport union station in the back room of an OPA sympathizer bar, the habits of secrecy died hard. As if on cue, Alex's hand terminal buzzed an alert at him. They were getting ready to transfer the Storm from its current ship to the new one. Naomi wasn't the only one living inside a high-stakes shell game. "Boss gonna go oversee the transfer," he said to Bobby. "I'll come with," she replied, then grabbed Naomi for one last fierce hug. "You stay safe, Exo." "That's all I do nowadays," Naomi said with a sad grin. Leaving her behind felt wrong, the way it always did. Alex would never admit it out loud, but the gathering storm scared the shit out of him. The Rocinante was still his first love, like a hand tool that grew to fit the shape of the hand that held it. The Rossi was comfortable, familiar, safe. For all that it was a dangerous warship, it still felt like home. It felt right. He missed it terribly. The Storm was like living inside an alien creature that was pretending to be an overpowered racing ship, and then someone had strapped a shit ton of firepower onto it. Where flying the Rossi felt like a collaboration, the ship an extension of his will, flying the Storm felt like a negotiation with a dangerous animal. Every time he sat in the pilot's chair, he worried about getting bitten. Bobby had gone over the ship with her techs from stem to stern and reassured him that there was nothing in the specs that made the Storm dangerous to her crew, or at least not more than all spaceships were dangerous to their crews. Alex remained unconvinced. There was something about using the controls that felt like the ship wasn't reacting to his inputs. It felt like the ship was interpreting them and agreeing with them, but also making its own damn decisions. The only person he'd ever confided this to was his co-pilot, Caspar Asoau. "I mean, yeah, the controls feel a little loose, I guess, but not sure that means the ship is fighting back," Caspar had said,
giving Alex a suspicious side-eyed glance. Alex hadn't brought it up again. But Alex had been flying spaceships for a lot of years now, and he knew what he knew. There was more to the storm than just metal and carbon and whatever that crystal-looking shit was, even if no one else could see it. Still, it was a damn beautiful ship. Alex stood at a small observation window and watched as it was carefully moved from the open hangar bay of their old transport ship to the new one. The two massive transports flanked the storm as it moved, and the enormous bulk of the transfer station's central hub overshadowed them both. It was all very deliberately done to block line of sight to all the known government telescope and radar stations. For all the Laconian Empire would ever know, two heavy freighters had briefly docked at the same transfer point, dropped off or picked up some cargo, and then gone their separate ways. That a stolen Laconian warship had been moved from one to the other wouldn't appear on any official records or in any video feeds, and the Storm and her crew would be free to live and fight another day, assuming they hadn't overlooked anything. The gleaming crystal and metal flanks of the ship seemed to glow with their own inner light, even in the Box Canyon shadow that two freighters in the transfer station created. Bright white puffs of superheated gas flashed and disappeared as the maneuvering thrusters fired. Casper would be at the controls, gently nudging the Laconian destroyer out of the open cargo bay of their old ship and into the new with practiced ease. They'd played this game a lot, and both pilots had become expert at moving the ship in very confined spaces. As a former military man, Alex was always surprised that they could actually manage to keep the conspiracy a secret. They were sneaking a stolen Imperial warship through the gate network, hidden in the bowels of transport union ships. At least dozens and maybe hundreds of people were directly involved. Somehow, they kept getting away with it. The Occam's razor argument to nearly all conspiracy theories was that people were really shitty at keeping secrets, and large groups of people were exponentially worse. But with the help of their former OPA friends in the transport union, they'd been sneaking and peeking for months without getting caught. It was a testament to how bred to insurgency the Belters had become over the last century or two. Hiding a rebellion from vastly superior military forces was in their DNA. During his 20 years as a member of the Martian Navy, and then later fighting the Free Navy, he'd had a part in hunting their more radical factions. Alex had often found the Belter capacity for subterfuge and guerrilla fighting infuriating. Now, it was literally keeping him alive. Alex wasn't sure if that was ironic or not. Funny, maybe. The Storm finished buttoning down in their new freighter. It was a cow of a cargo hauler, shaped like a fat bullet and named the Pendulum's Ark. Its doors slid shut and locked, and Alex felt a tiny tremor in the deck as they did. A pair of doors bigger than a destroyer had some mass to them. Alex pulled out his terminal and opened a channel to Bobby.
"The baby's tucked in. We can be Oscar Mike on your word."
"Copy that," Bobby said and killed the channel. She was off doing final prep with her team. Saba's chain of whispers hadn't told them what their mission in Seoul was, but Bobby kept her troops so drilled on the fundamentals that the specific mission just became a checklist of shit to get done. Alex had been skeptical when Bobby took a mixed bag of Old Guard OPA, stuffed them into Laconian Marine power armor, and said she was going to turn them into a legit covert op strike team, but damned if she hadn't done exactly that. They'd run 3 different operations with a 100% success rate and a 0% casualty rate. It turned out that as formidable as Gunny Draper was, she was even scarier when you let her train her own backup. There had to have been a moment when this had become the new normal. Playing their cargo ship version of three-card Monte with the Storm while Saba and Naomi and the rest of the underground picked mission targets for them. He couldn't say when it had passed.
Only now he was back to being the bus driver he'd been in the MCRN a few lifetimes ago. Every day carried the risk of discovery and capture. Or death. Every operation sent Bobby and her team into the meat grinder of the Laconian Dominion. For all their successes, they were walking on the edge of a razor blade. If he'd been 20 and unaware of his own mortality, he'd probably have loved it. He turned away from the observation window and picked up his gear bag. As he walked, his terminal squawked at him. "Locked and powered down," Casper said.
"I was watching. Elegantly done. The gunny will be drilling the troops, and I'm headed that way. Ship's yours for the duration."
"Copy that." The corridors of the transfer station were spare and functional, smooth taupe ceramic walls and a floor just padded enough to keep the occupants from getting shin splints in the habitat ring's 1/3 G rotation. Alex trudged along one for half a kilometer, then rapped at a door marked Storage 348-001. A grizzled belter opened it a crack and looked up and down the hallway around Alex. He had gray hair in a military-style buzz cut and flat gray eyes of almost exactly the same color. Alex could see the heavy black pistol he held behind his thigh as he checked to see if the corridor was clear. His name was Takeshi Oba, and he was one of Bobby's killers.
"All clear," Alex said with a smile, and Oba let him in with a grunt.
It was an empty room of about 5 by 10 meters with the same plain ceramic walls as the corridor outside. Bobby's team was standing in loose ranks facing her as she addressed them. She gave Alex a tiny nod as he entered, but didn't stop her speech. "Make no mistake," she was saying, "the Sol system is the most dangerous theater we've operated in. Its threat level is second only to Laconia for our style of covert op. Nearly every rock or chunk of ice bigger than a troop transport has a station, telescope, or radar emplacement on it. There are eyes everywhere." A mutter passed through the group, but Alex couldn't tell if it was grumbling or agreement. "And," Bobby continued, "the Earth-Mars Coalition fleet is entirely under Laconian control, which means the Laconians' relatively small number of ships, the one fact that has allowed us to operate up to this point, is not going to help us here. To make matters worse, the Laconians have left the dreadnought Heart of the Tempest in orbit around Earth. It's there primarily as a threat to keep the inner planets in line, but if it detects us, we are in a world of hurt. The Storm cannot survive an engagement with a Magnetar-class battleship. End of story."
"Any word yet on the target?"
Gillian Houston asked. She was the daughter of Freehold's Governor Payne Houston, and had been one of the first volunteers for Bobby's team. She was tall and rangy, with white blonde hair, the muscles and bone structure of a born Earther, and a perpetual scowl line between her eyes. She'd become Bobby's unofficial second in the time they'd worked together. Alex worried about that. Gillian was mean as a snake. When he told Bobby that, she'd responded, "I just make sure she never runs out of mice." He still didn't quite know what that meant.
"No, the kids upstairs are playing this one close to the vest," Bobby said. "It's starting to feel like we'll know when we're already doing it."
"Outstanding," Gillian said.
"The Storm is buttoned up and we'll be heading Solward in the pendulum in 30 hours, Bobby said. "Enjoy your time on Paternity Row, but make sure you're on the ship and squared away 24 hours from now, or find my foot uncomfortably up your ass."
That drew a good-natured chuckle from the crowd.
"Dismissed."
A few chaotic moments later, Bobby, Gillian, and Alex were the only three left in the room. Bobby still wore the nondescript flight suit she'd had on when they met with Naomi, but Gillian wore the black jumpsuit adopted by Bobby's strike team as its unofficial uniform. She also had a large pistol in a holster. Alex had never seen her without it. For freeholders, wearing a gun was like wearing pants.
"I don't like Saba giving us the runaround on this," Gillian said. "It feels like he's fucking improvising."
"There could be a lot of legitimate reasons why the mission details are still being formulated," Bobby replied.
Her voice was gentle but firm. "I understand your concern, but do it anyway," was implicit in it.
"It has to be Callisto," Jillian continued, as if she hadn't heard the quiet warning in Bobby's tone. "Only thing worth a damn that's far enough away from that battleship to be a realistic target."
Bobby took a half-step toward her and straightened up, magnifying the size difference between the two women. Jillian stopped talking, but didn't back down at all.
"Mean as a snake, and with giant brass balls," Alex thought.
"That sort of speculation is unproductive, and frankly dangerous," Bobby said. "Keep it to yourself. Go get a drink or five, get in a bar fight if you have to, but get it out of your system and be back at the storm tomorrow. We'll know more then." Dismissed. Jillian finally seemed to get the message. She threw Bobby a half-mocking salute and sauntered out of the room. Alex opened his mouth, and Bobby pointed her finger at him. "Don't fucking say it."
"Copy that," he said instead. "A day on station with nothing to do. Wish Naomi was hanging around. Could have done more than eat shitty kibble with her."
"She's got her mission, too," Bobby said, her lips pressed thin and pale.
"So," Alex said, "you gonna tell me what went on between you, or am I gonna have to beat it out of you?"
Caught off guard, Bobby let out a bark of laughter just the way he'd hoped she would. It was like a chihuahua threatening an office building, and Alex grinned to show he was in on the joke. Bobby sighed.
"She still thinks we should negotiate our way out of this."
"We disagree on that point. Same shit, different year."
"She's lost a lot," Alex said. "She's afraid of losing it all."
Bobby grabbed Alex's upper arm and gave it an affectionate squeeze.
"And that's the point I keep trying to make with her, my friend. In a fight like this, unless you're willing to lose everything to win, you lose it all by losing."
Chapter 4. Teresa.
"We don't know what they called themselves," Colonel Illich said, lying back on the grass, his hands pillowing his bald head. "We don't know that they called themselves anything, really. They may have done without language at all."
Teresa had known Colonel Illich her whole life. He was a fact of the universe, like stars or water. He was a calm, thoughtful presence in a life full to spilling with calm, thoughtful people. What made him different was that he was entirely focused on her. That, and that he wasn't afraid of her. He shifted, stretched.
"Some people call them the protomolecule, even though that was really just a tool they made. It'd be like calling humans wrenches. Protomolecule engineers is closer, but it's kind of a mouthful.
Initial organism, or the alien society, or the architects. They all get used to mean more or less the same thing."
"What do you call them?" Teresa asked. He chuckled.
"I call them the Romans, the great empire that rose and fell in antiquity and left their roads behind."
It was an interesting thought. Teresa turned it over in her mind for a few seconds like she was getting the taste of it. She liked the analogy not because it was accurate, but because it was evocative. That was what made analogies useful. Her mind wandered down that rabbit hole for a few breaths, seeing what was there, what was interesting in it, and decided to ask Timothy what he thought. He always had views that surprised her. It was why she liked him. He wasn't afraid of her any more than Colonel Illich was, but Illich's respect tasted like respect for her father, and that made it not lesser exactly, just different. Timothy was hers. She felt the quiet stretching on too long. Illich would be expecting her to say something, and Timothy wasn't something she talked about. She found something else.
"So, they built all of this?"
"Not all of it, no. The gates, the construction platforms, the repair drones, the artifacts, yes. But the living systems existed on the other worlds first. Stable replicators aren't as rare as we used to imagine.
A little water, a little carbon, a consistent stream of energy from sunlight or a thermal vent. Add a few million years, and more often than not, something will happen. Or, if it doesn't, then the Romans don't have anything to work from. 1,373 times that we know of, Illich said. That's a lot. The colony worlds, Sol system included, were only on the gate network because there had been life for the Romans to hijack. A few hundred systems in a galaxy of billions. Illich was old enough that anything more than one was miraculous to him. Teresa hadn't grown up in a lonely universe the way the Colonel had. She'd grown up in a lonely universe the way she had, and the two didn't compare. She closed her eyes and turned her face toward the sun. The light and heat felt good on her skin. The brightness pressed through her eyelids, turning everything red. Nuclear fusion filtered through blood. She smiled. Teresa Angelica Maria Blanquita Lee y Duarte knew that she wasn't a normal child, the way she knew that light reflected off a level surface became polarized. A not particularly useful academic fact. She was the only daughter of High Consul Winston Duarte, which all by itself meant her childhood had been strange. She'd lived her whole life in, or occasionally and clandestinely just outside, the state building on Laconia. Since she'd been a toddler, other children had been brought in to be her friends and classmates. Usually from the most favored families of the Empire, but sometimes because her father wanted her to know a variety of kinds of people. He wanted her to have as close as she could get to a normal life. To be as close as she could be to a normal 14-year-old. And it worked as well as it worked. But since she only had her own life to judge from, she couldn't really say how successful it had been. She felt more like she had friendly acquaintances than actual friends. Muriel Cowper and Sean Ellison particularly treated her best, or at least most like they treated other students in her peer group. And then there was Connor Weigel, who had been in her classes almost as long as she'd had them. He had a special place in her heart that she found herself curiously unwilling to examine. If she was lonely, and she assumed she was, she didn't have anything to compare it against. If everything in the world was red, no one would know it. Being everywhere was just as good a way to be invisible as not being anywhere. It was contrast that gave things shape. Brightness made darkness. Fullness made emptiness. Loneliness defined the borders of whatever not loneliness was called. They were comparative. She wondered if life and death were like that too, or life and not life, anyway. What killed them? She asked, opening her eyes. Everything looked blue. Your Romans, I mean. Well, that's the next step, isn't it? Colonel Illich said. Figuring that out and then building a strategy around what to do about it. We know whatever it is still out there. We've seen it react to things that we do. The thing on the Tempest, Teresa said. She'd seen the briefing on it. The first time Admiral Trejo used the Magnetar-class ship's main weapon in normal space, something had happened that knocked out people's consciousness all through Sol's system for a few minutes and left a visual distortion on the ship itself, locked to its frame of reference. It was why James Holden had come to the palace, which was really the aspect of it that had the biggest impact on her. Exactly, Illich said. He rolled onto his belly and propped himself up on his elbows to look at her. Eye contact was how he signaled that something he said was important. It's the most serious threat to our security. Either the Romans died because they ran up against some natural force that they weren't prepared for, or because an enemy killed them. That's what we're finding out first. How? She asked. We don't know how they killed the Romans. We're still just at the edge of understanding what they were compared to us. No, I mean, how are we finding out if it was an enemy or a natural force? Colonel Illich nodded to say it was a good question. He pulled out his handheld, tapped on it a few times, and brought up a grid. Teresa cooperates. Jason cooperates. Teresa 3, Jason 3. Teresa defects. Jason cooperates. Teresa 4, Jason 0. Teresa cooperates. Jason defects. Teresa 0, Jason 4. Teresa defects. Jason defects. Teresa 2, Jason 2. Prisoner's dilemma, Teresa said. You remember how it works? We both decide without talking whether to cooperate or defect. If we both cooperate, we both get 3 points. If only one of us cooperates, they don't get any points, and the defector gets 4. If we both defect, we both get 2. The problem is that no matter what you choose to do, I'm better off defecting. I get 4 instead of 3 if you cooperate, or else 2 instead of nothing if you defect. So I should always defect. But since the same logic applies to you, you should always defect too. And then we wind up both making fewer points than if we'd cooperated. So, how do you fix that? You don't. It's like saying, this statement is false. It's just a hole in logic, Teresa said. I mean, isn't it? Not if you play it more than once, Colonel Illich said. You play it over and over and over for a really long time. Every time the other player defects, you defect the next time. And then you go back to cooperating. It's called tit-for-tat. There's a pure game theory analysis of it I can give you if you want, but you don't need it for this. Teresa nodded, but slowly. Her head was thick, the way it got when she was thinking about something without quite being conscious of what it was. Usually something interesting came up shortly afterward. She liked the feeling.
Think of it like you were training Muskrat back when she was a puppy, Illich said.
The puppy wets the rug, and you scold it. You don't go on scolding it forever, just once when it happens, and then you go back to playing with it and petting it and treating it like a puppy. It defects, then you defect. Then you go back to cooperating. Until it figures out that there's a better strategy, Teresa said. And it changes its behavior. It's the most basic, simplest way we can negotiate with something we can't talk to. But what if you do the same thing with the tide? Punish the waves for getting the rug wet? Teresa scowled. Exactly, Colonel Illich said, as if she'd spoken aloud. If you scold the tide, it doesn't matter. It doesn't care. It doesn't learn. And most of all, it doesn't change. Your father is going to play tit-for-tat with the force that killed the Romans, and we're going to see if it changes its behavior. If it doesn't, we'll take the hypothesis that they ran up against a law of nature, like gravity making tides or the speed of light. Then we can study it and find ways around it. But if it changes, then we'll know it's alive. That's the difference between exploration and negotiating, Colonel Illich said, pointing at her. She felt the bloom of pleasure that she always got when she'd answered a knotty problem well, but something nagged at her. But it killed the Romans. War is a kind of negotiation, too, he said. Teresa's rooms were in the north wing of the state building, as were her father's. It was the only home she'd ever had. A bedroom built to military specifications, a private bathroom, and the room that had been her playroom and was now her office, the difference being mostly cosmetic. When she'd been ready to strip away the decorations of cartoon dinosaurs and puppies, she'd said so, and the next day a designer had come to help her choose a new color scheme and layout. Her corner of the state building wasn't large or ostentatious, but it was hers to customize and recreate. Her little bubble of autonomy. She'd chosen to make the office look like a science station. Her desk was tall enough to stand at, but also had long-legged stools along the side if she chose to sit. The east wall was a single screen set to run animations of simple mathematical and geometrical proofs when she wasn't watching a news or entertainment feed. It wasn't that she understood all the math, but she thought it was pretty. There was an elegance to the proofs, and having them there made her more aware of her intelligence. She liked being aware of her intelligence. But she also had a couch long enough that she could lie down on it and still have room for Muskrat, her Labrador, to curl up at her feet. And a real glass window that looked out over a ceremonial garden. There were whole days when, if she wasn't with Colonel Illich or in class, she'd curl up on the couch with Muskrat and read books or watch films for hours at a time. She had access to everything the censors approved. Her father was very liberal about giving her access to literature and film, and she gravitated to stories about girls who lived alone in castles or palaces or temples. For such a specific genre, it turned out there were quite a few. Her present favorite was a 10-hour feed made on Mars back before the gates opened, called The Fifth Tunnel. In it, the hero, who at 12 was now younger than Teresa, but had been older when she first watched it, discovered a secret tunnel under a city called Innis Deep, and followed it to a whole buried community with elves and fairies who needed help getting back to their dimension. It all seemed wildly exotic, and the idea of a girl who lived her whole life underground captured her imagination so much that she'd put a blanket over her windows and pretended that the darkness was made of Martian dirt. When her father told her that part was true, that there was an Innis Deep, and that Martian children did live in tunnels and buried cities, and that only the elves and fairies were inventions, it had astounded her. She was watching it again when her father came by. She'd just gotten to the part where the girl, whose name was never mentioned, was running through a dark hallway with the evil fairy called Pinsleep chasing her when the knock came. She was just getting up to answer it when the door opened. Only her father opened the door. Everyone else made her get it. The treatments had changed him over the last few years, but just growing up had changed her. It didn't seem weird. His eyes had developed more of their oil-on-water shimmer in the whites, and his fingernails had gone darker at the cuticles. But that was all just looks. In every way that mattered, he was the same. "Am I interrupting?" he asked, the way he always did.
It was half a joke, because she didn't have anything to interrupt, but only half.
If she'd ever said yes, he would have let her be. The nameless girl shrieked as Pinsleep lunged for her. Teresa paused the feed, and prey and predator both froze. Muskrat huffed, tail thumping against the couch as her father scratched the dog's wide ears. "I have a briefing in 2 hours," he said. "I'd like you to attend." Teresa felt a little prick of annoyance. She'd meant to go out and visit Timothy as soon as the feed was done. If they'd found out she was leaving the grounds without permission. "Did I do something wrong?" Her father blinked, then laughed. Muskrat pushed her head up into his hand, demanding more attention. He went back to rubbing her ears. "No, not at all. It's Admiral Waith's report on the expansion plan for Baragaon Complex. You aren't expected to contribute, but I'd like you to listen. Then afterward we can talk about it." Teresa nodded. If it was what he wanted, of course she could, but it sounded dull and strange. Her father's eyes went unfocused for a moment, the way they did sometimes, and then he shook his head like he was trying to clear it. He leaned against the arm of the couch, not quite sitting, but not standing either. He tapped Muskrat's side firmly twice in a way that meant petting time was over. The dog sighed and flopped her head down on the cushion. "Something's bothering you,"
he said.
"You've been asking me to do this more often," she said. "Am I doing it wrong?"
His laughter was warm, and it made her relax a little.
"When I was your age, I was pushing for early entrance to upper university. You're like me. You learn fast, and I want to keep up with you. I'm bringing you in more because you're old enough to understand things now that you weren't able to when you were a child, and Colonel Illich says that your studies are on track, even advanced."
She felt a little glimmer of pride in that, but also confusion. Her father sighed.
"It's hard work keeping people safe," he said. "Part of that is that we've come up against very dangerous, unknown things. I can wish that weren't the case, but I can't take it back. And the other part is that we're working with people.
And people are terrible, terrible monkeys," Teresa said.
"Yes, we are," her father said.
"We have a very close horizon almost all the time, including me. But I'm trying to get better." The way he said it, he sounded tired. She leaned forward, and Muskrat took it as a sign that she was looking for someone to pet. She shifted, breathing hot on Teresa's face until she gently pushed the dog back.
"Is the Baragaon complex expansion really important, then?" Teresa asked.
"Everything's important. All of it," her father said. "And so every part of it needs to be able to fail without destroying the whole project, including me, which is why I've been asking you to come to the briefings more often."
"What do you mean?" she said.
"I'm fine," her father said. "Everything's fine. There isn't a problem. It's only that if there were to be, sometime later, decades from now, someone would need to understand the shape of the whole plan and be able to step in. And people trust what they already know. Having a new High Council would be difficult under any circumstances, but it would be less difficult if there were a story with it, a succession. I want to train you to be that if, God forbid, something happened to me.
But why should I be good at it just because you were?" Teresa said. "There's no reason to think that. That's dumb."
"It is," her father said. "But it's a mistake people have made all through history. And since we know that, the two of us can use the tool we've been given. Come sit in the briefings and the meetings. Listen. Watch. Talk to me afterward. This is the next phase of your education, so that if you need to step in, you'll actually be the leader they need you to be."
It took a few seconds to really understand what he was saying. The huge moments in life seemed like they should have more ceremony and effects. The important words, the life-changing ones, should echo a little. But they didn't. They sounded just like everything else.
"You want to train me up to be the next High Council, in case something happens to me," Duarte said.
"But just in case," she said.
"Only just in case."
"Just in case, Princess," he said.
Chapter 5. Elvie. A few decades earlier, and about 200,000 trillion kilometers from where she currently sat, a tiny node of active protomolecule in a biological matrix had entered the orbit of a planet called Illis, hitchhiking on the gunship Rocinante. As the uncanny semi-sentient intelligence of the protomolecule tried to make contact with other nodes in the gate builder's long-dead empire, it woke up mechanisms that had been dormant for millions or even billions of years. The end result had been an ancient factory returning to life, a massive robot attack, the melting of one artificial moon, and the detonation of a power plant that nearly cracked the planet in two. All in all, a really shitty experience.
So when Elvie's team took the catalyst out of isolation in unexplored systems to do a similar, if slightly better controlled, reaching out to the artifacts and remains, she made sure they were careful. They watched what happened. They were ready to put the catalyst back in its box, and they didn't get too close to anything.
"Falcon in position," the pilot said. If anything went terribly wrong, the pilot or Segale or Elvie could give a single spoken order. Emergency evacuation, their name, and the Delta 8 authorization code, and the ship would take it from there. Given the Falcon's oversized engine and massive acceleration, anyone not in one of the ship's specially designed high-G couches would be injured or killed, but the data they'd already collected would be preserved. Laconia had a lot of fail-safe logic like that. It wasn't her favorite part of the job.
"Thank you, Lieutenant," Admiral Segale replied. He was strapped into a crash couch on the bridge, too. Another sign of how seriously everyone took this part of the mission.
"Major Okoye, you may proceed."
"Take her out," Elvie said into the comm. In this situation, there was only one her. Elvie sat in her custom Laconian crash couch, surrounded by screens. The instruments could be yanked away in under a second, and the couch chamber filled with a breathable fluid for high-G burn shortly after. She was one of the few people important enough that efforts would be made to keep her alive. It felt like working inside a torpedo. She kind of hated it. On one of her screens, a camera tracked the movement of the catalyst as she was wheeled out of her storage room on a high-tech gurney covered in sensors. Protomolecule communication went both ways. What happened to their sample was just as important to their study as what happened to the dead system that they might be about to activate. The catalyst's gurney moved on magnetic wheels down the corridor to a compartment in the skin of the ship, away from all the radiation shielding and whatever high-tech wizardry Cortazar's team had come up with to lock their sample away from the rest back beyond the gate. Nothing happened.
"No response yet," Trevon said.
"Gee, really?" Faez replied, the sarcasm in his tone meant for everyone else. Trevon wouldn't hear it. While the protomolecule might communicate in ways that looked like they were faster than light once it got going, it didn't start it right away. Since locality wasn't a big deal for the protomolecule, but the speed of light was, Elvie suspected it was some slower-than-light handshake as the two network nodes agreed on the protocol to be used. That was somewhere between a guess and a metaphor, but it helped her to think about it. Her sample came out of Cortazar's laboratory pens. It hadn't existed until the recent past. Everything they were trying to interact with here had been waiting since humanity had been a kinky idea that two amoebas came up with. So somehow, when her node came into physical proximity, meaning somewhere in the same solar system, for the first time, they were creating some kind of relationship to each other on the fly. Which was awesome, but also weird. And not how quantum entanglement worked, unless somehow it was. In her study of the protomolecule and the civilization that had created it, Elvie often found herself glad she wasn't a physicist. What the protomolecule did biologically, while not entirely explicable yet, at least seemed like it might be fully understood someday. The mechanisms by which it hijacked life and repurposed it were incredibly advanced, but not totally dissimilar to things like viruses and parasitic fungi. She didn't understand all the rules yet, but she felt like she could, given enough time and research. What the protomolecule did to physics looked less like a variation and refinement of the standard models, and more like kicking the game table over and scattering the pieces across the floor. Elvie wondered if Jen Lively's constant lighthearted joking was so she didn't go insane as her understanding of reality was ripped to shreds in front of her on a daily basis.
"Getting a reaction," Trevon said.
"Yeah," Jen agreed. "Something's happening in the object." What was the delay on that? Elvi asked. 18 minutes. They were 9 light minutes from the structure, so that made a handshake propagating at or near C plausible. She really needed to write that hypothesis up and run it past the nanoinformatics staff. Elvi's screens went wild with readings from the catalyst sensor package. It was too much data to be analyzed in real time, so Elvi let it wash over her like a wave of numbers and graphs.
There would be plenty of opportunity later to figure out what it all meant.
Looking stable so far, Trevon said.
Always glad when things don't immediately blow up, Elvi said, but no one laughed.
You know what makes a diamond green? Jen asked everyone and no one. I looked it up.
Radiation, Fire said.
Of course he knew. He'd been on the Illis team, too, as its geologist. While the opening of the protomolecule gate network had given Elvi more than 1,300 new biospheres to study, it had given Fires 10 times that many new geologies to explore. Some of them as exotic as a great huge lump of carbon crystal that was a really pretty color.
Diamonds that form in the presence of radiation can get that green color. Some people mistake them for emeralds, but totally different mineral. Emeralds are beryl, not carbon.
Stealing my thunder there, sport, Jen said, but I'm betting it means that this star was a lot more active when the object was formed. My best guess, based on stellar decay, is that the object is almost 5 billion years old. That's been hanging out for about a third of the time the universe has, you know, existed.
That would make it one of the oldest artifacts we've found, Trevon said, suddenly interested. Maybe something from the very beginning of their civilization.
Fascinating,
Segali said, his clipped tones the only sign of his impatience. What's it doing?
What's it doing that helps us fight ghoulies from beyond time and space, was the implied question. For all her bottomless budget, for all the cream-of-the-crop science team she'd been given and her custom-built state-of-the-art ship, there was only one result the High Consul and his science directorate cared about. How do we stop the things that eat ships passing through the gates?
I don't know, she said. Let me take a look.
18 hours into their data collection, Elvi retired to her cabin. She'd learned early on that the military discipline of the Laconians didn't extend to forcing people to work on no rest. Duarte wanted everyone at peak efficiency. Baked into that was the idea that most people would spend a third of their day sleeping. When Elvi climbed out of her couch and said she needed to rest before she began her analysis, Segala didn't bat an eye. It was a trick she'd started using to buy uninterrupted work time. She'd been able to go 24 hours straight since grad school. Some caffeine tablets and hot tea, and she could go 48 if she needed to. Not sleeping bought her 8 or 9 hours without Sagale's questions about results and timetables. But the gag only worked if everyone pretended that she actually was sleeping, so for Fires to burst in meant he had something big.
It made a copy.
Before Elvi could ask what had made a copy and what it had made a copy of, he'd floated over to the dining table in the middle of her cabin and slapped his terminal down on it. The electromagnetics in the table kept the terminal from floating away, but the impact sent Fires tumbling gently toward the wall. He was an Earther, born and raised, and no matter how much time he spent in space, he never seemed to lose that instinctive expectation of gravity. As he drifted away, he yelled at the table,
"Show her! Show her the thing! Display last file, volumetric display!"
A holographic map of what looked like a human brain appeared, floating above the table.
The brain sparked with flashing synaptic paths, probably an fMRI or fNIRS scan. Elvi had seen this particular brain often enough to know it belonged to the catalyst, that it had been a woman once upon a time. Fayez hit the bulkhead and pushed off with one foot, rejoining her at the table.
A lot of activity, Elvi said, but taking her out of her pen might be causing her stress or physical discomfort.
Nothing here is all that unusual.
That's just her being her, Fires said, shaking his head and tapping away at his terminal. Look at this. A second image appeared. It took Elvie a moment to recognize that it was a copy of the catalyst's brain activity, but without the physical structure of the brain. I don't understand. What's that second image from?